Ian held the phone with his teeth again while he readjusted his clothes. Once done, he checked the picture and smiled.
Perfection.
Then he handed his mobile back to the now open-mouthed attendant. When a big blonde sod named Dagon comes looking for me, show him this and tell him I said to kiss it.
Chapter 6. We waited near the remaining wall of the former movie theater in Quomino. Ian had been right. The entire town looked as if it had been abandoned decades ago. The last time I'd been in this area had been after World War II. Then the Soviet army had turned it into a military base. Now the only signs of life were the few faint heartbeats coming from the rubble around the former theater. They probably wouldn't have mobile phones. Even if they did, they might not bother to come out in this weather. It was bitterly cold. Homeless humans seeking temporary refuge, no doubt. We'd left the car several miles away and walked to Quomino. We drew less notice this way, but I hadn't dressed warmly since I hadn't intended to be outside for long. My coat was more to give myself a place to put my weapons than to protect against the cold. Being a vampire meant I wouldn't get hypothermia, but it did nothing to insulate me from the freezing temperatures. Another gust of wind sliced into me, bringing with it the scent of snow. It would be a white Christmas in a few hours. I hoped to be far away by the time the first snowflakes fell. I glanced over at Ian. He didn't seem bothered by the cold, and his coat was as thin as mine. Then again, he was from England, and I came from the warmer climate of the Middle East. Some things not even the passage of time could dilute. My dislike of cold was one of those. I checked my mobile again. 12:45. I hope Vlad didn't pick tonight to go back on his word, I murmured, more to myself than to Ian. He cast an unconcerned glance at the sky.
He won't.
Then he looked back at me.
I've run through many possibilities, but I can't place the origin of your accent.
My accent? I had mastered so many languages over the centuries, I thought I'd long gotten rid of any telltale hallmarks from my original one.
It's very slight, he assured me. Yet every so often it peeks out, just like when you occasionally use words that haven't been popular since America sewed its first flag.
Vampires might not be modern humans, but we should keep striving to sound like them, I said, repeating one of Tenok's most frequent admonitions. Then I paused. Why had I shared that? He nodded.
Too right. We'd whip heads around if we spouted these and thous everywhere. Some old vamps refuse to modernize. Outs them to humans faster than flashing fang.
Tenok had felt the same way.
That's why my sire had been so adamant about my embracing the new, whether that was speech, clothing styles, mannerisms, or technological advancements.
You didn't answer my question,
Ian went on, a gleam appearing in his eyes.
Where did you get your accent? Ancient Sumer, perhaps. You do speak Sumerian better than anyone I've ever heard.
When have you heard it? I asked to turn this line of questioning around. It's long been a dead language.
His brow rose.
Yes, and most of Sumer's culture's been lost to history, too, so no one would know an authentic accent even if they heard it. I happened to learn Sumerian when a demon I was mates with taught it to me. How did you learn it?
Nothing changed in my expression, although inwardly I flinched. How did I end up on the defensive end of a conversation about demons and my original homeland? I had to redirect the conversation, fast.
Some spells are more effective in their original language. When you're a law guardian tasked with fighting various forms of magic, it behooves you to learn those languages.
Why would you bother to learn one no one speaks anymore? I let out a slight scoff.
Although I'm not surprised a demon taught it to you. Demons have been around longer than humans and vampires both, and they love to prove their imagined superiority over lowly walking corpses, as most demons see vampires.
Ian appeared to mull that over.
Plausible.
Then he threw a cheery grin at me.
But you're still hiding something. Rest assured, I will find out what it is.
The roar of an approaching plane kept me from responding, which was good.
Otherwise, I might have threatened to kill him again.
That would have only made things worse. He intended to take a death threat as a challenge, a joke, or an aphrodisiac. After it landed, the sleek plane used all of the empty parking lots to come to a stop. Then it waited, exterior running lights off, so it didn't stand out like a beacon in the dark. We ran over to the plane, reaching it right as the door opened.
"Cheers,"
Ian said, vaulting into the open doorway. Then he stopped so suddenly that I plowed into his back when I jumped in after him. I pushed Ian aside so I wasn't hanging half out of the doorway anymore. With him no longer blocking me, I saw the plane contained more than the two vampire pilots. A third vampire reclined on a leather sofa in the plane's sumptuous interior. His long black hair matched the Stygian shade of his eyes, and his skin was the same golden bronze as my own. I should have felt him before I saw him, except he was one of the few vampires in the world with enough power to tamp his aura down until he felt like a mere human. Now that he'd succeeded in surprising us, Menkaris released his hold, and an invisible shockwave filled the plane. It felt like thousands of stings erupted across my skin as his aura rolled over me. At the same time, the air suddenly felt heavy, as if it had morphed into the ocean, and we were plunging toward the crushing pressure of the bottom. I had to fight the urge to take a step backward. I would show no weakness, even if Menkaris was one of the few people that I considered to be a friend. I was old enough to remember Menkaris before he had fangs, let alone a pyramid built in his honor.
"Bugger!" Ian swore. "What are you doing here?"
Ian's sire smiled at him.
"Happy Christmas, Ian."
Then Menkaris' dark gaze landed on me.
"Veritas,"
he said, drawing out all three syllables of my name.
"Please enlighten me as to what you think you're doing with one of my favorite offspring."
Chapter 7. I exchanged a glance with Ian. In that single look, I knew Ian didn't want me to reveal our true mission. I agreed. Menkaris was what they called old school when it came to the long-standing practice of vampires staying away from demons. That's why he really wouldn't support our attempt to kill one. The one thing demons could be counted on for was how they avenged the death of their own. No sensible master vampire of any line would involve his people in that quagmire. A smart one like Menkaris would also take active steps to stop someone he cared about from doing it too. That's why I'd rather stare down the entire ruling council than the vampire opposite me. For one, Menkaris might be the only vampire with enough power to actually stop us, if he knew what we intended. For another, I didn't want to involve him in something that would likely get at least one of us killed.
"Menkaris, how lovely to see you," I said, in my most innocent tone.
"Don't patronize me,"
he replied irritably. That put me on alert. Menkaris could level this area with a thought, so he rarely bothered to let himself get to the point of annoyance.
"Vlad already told me Ian was in serious trouble."
"Dick?" Ian breathed.
"Leave it to Vlad to both honor his debt and get revenge at the same time. Have you placed Ian under arrest for something?"
Menkaris asked me, ignoring that. "No," I said, relieved to tell the truth about that, at least. Menkaris' gaze narrowed.
"Then why would you, a law guardian, be spending time with him? Ian's contempt for the law is outweighed only by his abhorrence for celibacy."
Ian mimed hefting a glass in salute.
"True that."
I cast about for a quick excuse. "I'm, what was the modern term? Slumming it. I do that sometimes to relax."
"Lies," Menkaris said sharply. "You haven't relaxed since Caesar was stabbed by Brutus. You also almost never take vampires as lovers. So, oh?"
Ian interrupted, interest sparking in his gaze.
"So since you're not arresting Ian or slumming it with him," Menkaris continued, "what are you doing, Veritas?"
I couldn't think up a convincing excuse, so I decided to go with brazenness. I straightened to my full height. Ian is master of his own line, and he can tell you himself that he's with me of his own free will. The rest isn't your concern. Menkeri stared at me until it felt as if his gaze was boring into me. I didn't flinch. We might be nearly equal in strength, but even with all his great power, he couldn't kill me. Not permanently. Ian tapped on the plane's open door in obvious impatience.
Can we continue this pissing contest in the air?
Menkeri's took that destructive gaze from me and settled it on Ian.
Why? What sort of trouble are you in a hurry to escape from?
The words this time weren't spoken, but they hung in the air. From the way Ian stiffened, he sensed them too.
As the lady said, I'm here of my own will, so it's not your concern. Happy Christmas, Menkeri's. Grand to see you, but you have a wife to return to, and we have our own places to be.
Menkeri's released more of his power. The entire plane began to shake from the force of his aura. I had to resist the urge to wrap my arms around myself. It felt as if my guts might spill right out of me. All Ian did in response to this tremendous display was yawn. Since vampires didn't need to breathe, it was as blatant as a stiff middle finger.
Have it your way,
Menkeri's finally said in a dark tone.
I will get the truth from Vlad. No, you won't, Ian said instantly. If that wanker was going to sell me out, he already would have.
Menkeri's drew all his power back in. My stomach dropped and my coat fluttered, as if buffeted by a strong breeze. Then the former pharaoh's gaze softened as he stared at Ian.
Why, after everything we've been through, will you not simply trust me enough to confide in me?
For a second, pain darkened Ian's gaze, and his cocky demeanor cracked. Just as quickly, those flashes vanished, and he smiled, bright and confident as the rising sun.
Don't fret. I've got things well in hand.
Menkeri said nothing. The silence turned into a weight that should have dented the floor. I didn't glance at my mobile, but I was keenly aware of the minutes ticking by. We needed to leave. Soon this plane would attract the wrong kind of notice.
Have it your way,
Menkeri said again. A flick of his hand later, the door closed by itself. Then the pilots turned the plane around and began to taxi down the lot. Within moments, we were in the air, the faint lights of the city growing dimmer beneath us. I sat down in one of the cream-colored seats. Now that the standoff was over and Poland was disappearing behind us, I was relieved enough to realize I was hungry. I hadn't fed since yesterday morning. Maybe I'd be lucky, and Vlad's plane would be stocked with a few blood bags. Menkeri's leaned back on his couch. His posture was still relaxed, but when I met his gaze, I knew that was a lie. His eyes resembled black diamonds as he stared at me.
We share the same sire, and we have known each other for thousands of years. That is why I want you to mark me well now, Veritas. Ian is reckless and impulsive, but you are not. You plan everything down to the last detail, so factor this into the plans you refuse to share with me. I will hold you responsible if Ian dies in whatever scheme you're involving him in. Menkeri's, Ian began. Do not interrupt, he said harshly. You are correct. I cannot command you any longer, but neither can you command me. If I choose to avenge you, if she is careless with your life, that is my concern, not yours.
He'd thrown our earlier defiant words right back at us. My teeth ground. Menkeri's threat might not be Ian's concern, but it was now mine. He didn't bluff. His normal course of action was to telekinetically rip the head off anyone who pissed him off. That sort of decisiveness made threats unnecessary. Menkeri's had taken the time to threaten me. I took that seriously, even if he couldn't kill me as easily as he could the rest of the world. Instead of being comforted by his sire's vow of vengeance, Ian appeared exasperated.
Know what you are, Menkeri's? You're a bloody helicopter, Mom.
I stifled my burst of laughter, turning it into a wheeze that fooled no one. Menkaris gave me a sour look, but now I couldn't stop picturing him as one of those overprotective parents who constantly hovered over their children. Menkaris gave me another, "this isn't funny" look, before returning his attention to Ian.
"You are not so strong that you are immune to death. I care for all the vampires I have sired, but there are few I love as if they were my own children. You are one of those few, and something is very wrong with you. I could sense it even before Vlad warned me tonight."
Ian came and slung an arm around my shoulder. I stiffened but allowed it, reeling to see where he was going.
"See this lovely hellion?"
he asked.
"She's so powerful, I can barely keep my cock from standing at constant attention around her. More to the point, she's extremely invested in keeping me alive. Take assurance from that, even if you can't take assurance from my own determination not to get killed."
Menkaris looked back and forth between us. I schooled my features to show nothing except confidence. Ian took another approach. He looked me up and down with leisurely appreciation, then pulled me even closer.
"And soon, this little vixen will want to keep me alive for many more reasons than that," he all but purred.
I was willing to appear friendly, but I would not be treated as if I were a predetermined conquest. Ian claimed to enjoy pain. Let's see how much he enjoyed this. I threw an elbow into his side that broke all the ribs it came into contact with. Well, he let out a loud, "oof!" I removed his arm from my shoulder with enough force to break that, too. "If your cock comes anywhere near me, I will rip it off," I said in my most pleasant voice. "However, I am very invested in keeping Ian alive, Menkaris," I added, pivoting back to him. "Regardless, your threat is noted. Now continue your conversation by yourselves. I'm keeping my own company for the rest of the flight." Then I moved to the section of the plane that was the farthest away from them. I could feel someone's gaze on me the entire time, but I didn't turn around to see if it was Ian or Menkaris. Chapter 8. Menkaris didn't stay long. When the plane flew over Romania, he left. He could have had the pilots land first. Instead, he used his power to form an invisible barrier over the door, so we didn't suffer a catastrophic loss of cabin pressure when he opened it. Then he jumped out, closed the plane door, and resealed it with his power, and flew away. Menkaris wasn't normally this showy with his abilities. His dramatic mode of exit was another warning. I'd known he was fond of Ian, but I hadn't expected this. Menkaris was making it clear that he held Ian's life in the highest possible regard, and I had better do so too. That was a problem. I'd meant it when I told Menkaris I was invested in keeping Ian alive, but that investment had an expiration date. Once Ian succeeded in bringing Dagon to my trap, my focus would shift to bringing the demon to his long-overdue justice, not to preserving Ian's life. Now I had to kill Dagon while making sure both Ian and I survived. How?
"Thank God he's finally gone,"
Ian said, sauntering over to my side of the plane. I considered ignoring him. I told him I was keeping my own company, after all. Then I decided to ask what I'd been wondering about this past hour. "Why are you refusing to tell Menkaris about Dagon?" His lips tightened before he covered that with a careless smile.
"Because he'd ruin our fun."
"His power would be very useful," I pointed out.
"Think he'd agree to use me as bait to draw a demon out?"
Ian rolled his eyes.
"Naive doesn't suit you."
"It doesn't," I agreed, my tone hardening. "So stop pretending Menkaris wouldn't agree to anything if he knew your soul was on the line. I didn't know that 2 hours ago, but now it's obvious. So why are you refusing to tell him about Dagon, even though his involvement would increase your chances of survival?"
"I don't owe you a reason,"
Ian said, spinning around. I caught him before he made it down the aisle.
"Yes, you do. Menkaris all but said he'd murder me if you died, so if I survive and you don't, I'll have to battle one of my oldest allies to the death. I refuse to do that without at least knowing why."
Ian's jaw clenched and emerald blazed from his eyes. At the same time, I felt his muscles coiling beneath my hands, as if he were trying to hold something wild inside him. If we weren't several thousand feet in the air, I'd think he was about to attack me. But if we fought under these circumstances, we'd bring the plane down, and that would cause bigger problems for both of us.
Ben-Kerry's saved me, Ian finally said. I didn't let go of him.
All vampires save the humans they sire. That can't be all there is. Now his hands landed on my shoulders as well.
Ever been lost? I don't mean unaware of where you are. I mean lost in every sense of the word. Hundreds of years ago, I fled a brutal New South Wales penal colony for the even harsher Australian outback. I was dying of thirst, half blind from the sun, and racked with pain from fighting off the local wildlife. It didn't take long to hope to die by croc or venomous snake, so it would be quick instead of more agony. But none of that was the worst part.
His voice thickened.
The worst part was knowing no one cared enough to save you. That's what you remember forever. Not the physical pain or the never-ending fear, but the despair of being utterly alone and knowing you'll die that way. Ever been lost like that?
Memories rocketed to the surface. So strong and fast, my throat closed and my eyes stung with the instant surge of tears. It took all of my willpower not to allow these tears to fall as something long buried inside me began to scream.
Tenok, you saved me, and I failed you when you needed me the most. I'm so sorry, my beloved sire. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I had to look away from Ian, or I'd lose the remainder of my control. I couldn't bear to see the echo of my own pain reflected in the naked emotion of Ian's gaze. He might be loath to reveal his real feelings, but when he did, he let them burst forth in all their scalding intensity. Yes, I could barely force the word out for fear of my voice breaking. I've been lost like that before. Many times. He released me so abruptly, I took a step back to steady myself.
Then you know why I refuse to hurt Menkerys by telling him the truth. If Dagon kills me, Menkerys will grieve. But if he knew my soul was lost, too.
His lips twisted.
Not that I'd given him any cause to hope for that stained, shriveled husk, even before my deal with Dagon. But Menkerys has ever seen the best in me. And I can say that about no one else in this world.
Tenok had always seen the best in me, too. He'd also never given up on me. Not even when he'd given up on himself. If I could have saved him from one more moment of pain, I would have done so, gladly. That's why I had only one response. I won't tell Menkerys about your deal with Dagon.
Ever.
Ian stressed, tilting my chin so I'd meet his gaze. I looked into his vivid turquoise eyes and repeated the vow. Ever. He smiled then. The lines from his former pain wiped from his expression, as if they had never been there.
Grand. Now, since I'm supposed to be following your lead, and don't think that won't change soon, let's hear your doubtlessly boring plan to murder Dagon.
I forced the pain he'd brought to the surface back down, until it was contained by the cell that had long housed it. Well, I said, my voice as light as his, even though both of us were faking it. I was going to start by parading you in front of other mages, witches, and demon kin, with a near reckless disregard of the danger, so word of it could reach Dagon. Ian laughed, throwing his head back until I could see the vibrations in the pale expanse of his throat. When he stopped and met my gaze, he had a devilish curl to his lips, and his gaze was lit up with more interest than I'd ever seen.
Now you're talking.
Chapter 9. Several days later, we were in Horseshoe, Ontario, on the Canadian side of Niagara Falls. I had a great view of those falls through the floor-to-ceiling windows in our hotel suite. I was surprised to see how crowded it was since it was winter. Perhaps the additional people were tourists who'd chosen to celebrate New Year's Eve here. A few more might have braved the temperatures from the recent freeze to see the formations that coated the rocks and trees around the falls in dazzling layers of ice. Either way, it would serve to our advantage. We could get lost in the crowds if need be. Furthermore, with the incredible energy these falls produce, it would be easy to tap into my connection with water to fuel a spell. As a last resort, the falls themselves could provide protection. A continuous mist rose from them, and I had several demon-repelling salt bombs that could be widely dispersed through it. Ian came out of the suite's second bedroom. He wore black leather pants that hung low on his hips, and a silver dress shirt. When Ian came closer, I saw his shirt was so sheer it revealed far more than it concealed. Ian's flawless skin gleamed beneath the fabric, catching the eye and holding it. That must be why he'd chosen such a wholly inappropriate garment. His only nod to the near-zero temperatures were boots and a thick coat slung over his arm. He laughed when he saw me.
"You're wearing that ridiculous uniform. Thought you left the other one in my room as a joke."
I cast a look at my long-sleeved, high-necked black unitard. "There's a reason we have to wear these tonight."
"Let me guess, we're cosplaying as Storm and Cyclops."
I was about to explain the need for the rubberized unitards. Then I paused. Let him deal with the consequences of not following my lead, as he'd repeatedly failed to do.
"Have it your way,"
I said, encasing my high heels in thick rubber boots that gripped my calves. Ian's pitying gaze swept over me.
"If this is how you dress when you socialize, I'm starting to understand why you're still single."
I arched a brow.
"How do you know I'm single?"
He sauntered over.
"We've been together for days, yet you've not once called someone to check in. Furthermore, you certainly smelled single. If celibate were a fragrance, consider yourself doused in it."
I ignored that. "Before we leave, I'm going to use glamour to change my appearance. Needless to say, I don't want to be recognized."
"Lest every vampire run for their lives when they realize a law guardian caught them indulging in magic,"
he supplied. "Exactly." With that, I sprinkled some finely sifted powder over my head and spoke in a language Ian shouldn't know. He regarded me with amusement.
"Been a while since I heard Icelandic. Superb pronunciation, by the way."
Damn it. Did I need to speak Klingon to finally stump him? I ground my teeth but finished the spell. I could tell from the look on his face when it set in. A slow whistle escaped him.
"Bugger me."
My golden bronze skin stayed the same, but my hair was now longer, thicker, and so light blonde it could have been mistaken for platinum. Gold and blue lowlights wove through it, giving the tricolored mass a dyed look, even though it was natural. My dark blue-green eyes had also lightened to silver, and I'd grown until I was just under his 6'2 frame in my heels. My body had filled out too. Gone was the litheness that had led him to wonder if I was half his weight. Now my breasts were round and generous, as were my hips, and my arms and legs were well fleshed with muscle. Even my scent had changed. After Ian's gaze had done a thorough mapping of my body, it kept returning to my face, where features that had been moderately pretty before were now on the startling side of beautiful. I ignored his fixation and wound my hair into a knot on top of my head. Then I affixed a rubber hood over it and tucked it into my neckline so I was fully covered. The last touch was tight rubber gloves that went to my elbows. Ian finally stopped staring.
"If your aim was to take the edge off this spectacular appearance, you failed. Everyone will still want to shag you, even if they laugh at your ridiculous onesie first. You should have glamoured a less dazzling appearance if you didn't want to stand out so."
"This is my usual look when I visit these places," I said, which was the truth.
"Least it will keep me from being called a cradle robber,"
Ian said cheerfully.
"You might be lovely, but you do look more like a prom queen than one of my usual dates in your normal appearance."
"I'm so glad I can protect your reputation," I said with false sweetness. More importantly, with this appearance, I can be recognized by my former friends, if any of them are here. Allies will be useful if we need to engineer a quick escape.
You have friends in magical places?
His smile turned sly.
Why, little guardian, do you indeed go slumming at times?
When you're as old as I am, you end up doing a little of everything at some point, was my evasive reply. His chuckle was a low rumble of amusement and sensuality.
I'd say I could imagine, but I'd rather you show me.
I gave him a pointed look.
Not in this lifetime.
He let out a dramatic sigh.
Another sexual hoarder. Can't escape them these days, it seems. Ah, well, we have places to be and a demon to mercilessly taunt, so let's get to it, shall we?
I hid my smile as I gave his barely clad chest and thin leather pants a last look. Yes, let's.
What the bloody hell did you say?
The sound from the falls was loud, but I didn't think that was why Ian was pretending he hadn't heard me. He just didn't like what I'd said. That's why I relished repeating it.
We have to jump into the river so we can go over the falls.
He glanced at the churning waters, where thick ice chunks regularly crashed into each other.
Like hell we do!
The place we're going to is spelled to prevent just anyone from coming in, I said, fighting back my grin. I don't know the new magical version of a password, but I remember the old one. It requires going over Bridal Veil Falls while wearing the right symbol.
Then I couldn't resist adding, I told you to put on the unitard. Next time, follow my lead. He stared at the icy, frothing water before he gave me a truly evil glare.
Enjoy your victory now. I know I'll enjoy mine when I repay you for this.
Ooh, I'm shaking in my warm, waterproof boots, I mocked, my grin finally breaking free.
He kept glaring as he stripped off his coat, shirt, and boots, placing them by a nearby tree. Then he gave the river a resigned glance.
My knobs will turn into ice cubes.
Probably, I agreed, and took a small rouge pot from inside my boot. The substance inside wasn't rouge, so it didn't leave a visible trail as I traced the necessary pattern, first over my face, then over Ian's. When I was done, I threw the pot aside and gave a final glance around. No one was watching us. The few remaining tourists out at this hour were near the head of the falls, where multicolored lights shone on the roaring waters, giving the falls an ethereal look as they endlessly spilled over the ledge.
Keep hold of my hand, I told Ian as I held it out.
My grip was strong, but so were these waters. Plus, there were many rocks hidden beneath the surface, and all this was before the treacherous drop over the falls. His fingers tightened on mine as he took it. Then he surprised me by grinning.
Can't say I prefer the cold, but I have thought of doing this before. Here's to crossing one more item off my bucket list.
With that, he yanked me into the freezing depths of the fast-moving water. I stifled a gasp as it hit the bare skin on my face. Extreme cold didn't feel freezing. It burned. I instantly felt guilty as I imagined how much pain Ian must be in. I should have insisted he go back to the hotel to put on the rubber unitard. Ian's roar when his head broke the surface caused more guilt to slam into me. That turned into amazement when I realized he was laughing.
Lucifer's flaming farts, now this hurts!
He cried, attempting to spin me in a circle. The water was too strong. He only succeeded in dunking us both.
You can't be enjoying this, I sputtered when we broke the surface again.
Right you are,
he sang out, the words choppy because currents kept slamming water into his face.
No, how many props it takes to duplicate this?
Don't want to,
I managed before the current choked off my reply. We were picking up speed as the precipice neared. Bridal Veil might be the smallest part of Niagara Falls, but it was still a very significant waterfall.
Brace!
I shouted, gripping his hands with all my strength when the horizon of water abruptly disappeared. I thought I heard him laugh again as we went over the falls, but I couldn't be sure. The roar of water deafened me. Chapter 10. I coughed out the water that had flooded my lungs, hearing Ian do the same. The alcove behind the falls fit us both, but I was surprised to see there was no longer a cave beyond it, too. At some point since I'd last been here, the cave must have been demolished. Good thing the place we were going wasn't in there. I realized I was still holding Ian's hand and finally let go. He immediately began rubbing his arms and torso.
Tell me, it's warm where we'll be, he said through chattering teeth.
Looked like he was over the thrill of the icy pain. It should be, I said, feeling guilty again. I went over to the farthest corner of the alcove. Good. The large flat rock that marked the entry was still there. I rested my face against the smoothest part, making sure the invisible symbol on my forehead touched the rock. After a second, the stone dissolved, and an entryway appeared. This way, I said. Ian sprang up and followed me through the new door.
What would happen if anyone tried to go through without this mark?
If they didn't have the other magical passcode, the wall would rematerialize and bash them in the face. He let out a snort.
Effective.
It was, which is what had made this place a favorite sort of speakeasy for the magically inclined. Having to access it by going over the falls was inconvenient, but there were other ways to get in. If I had bothered to keep in touch with my old friends from this place, we could have found out those ways and climbed down the cliffs to this entrance without needing to go over the falls and get soaked. I began to strip off my hood, rubber boots, and the rest of my wetsuit as we walked deeper into the narrow passageway. Beneath it, I wore a form-fitting black velvet dress that redirected Ian's attention in a flash when he saw it. "We'll start off by looking for Rufus," I said as I shook my hair out from its bun. "He's an old friend of mine." My voice trailed off as the passageway ended in a large open space. The last time I'd been here, countless orbs had floated around the room, illuminating everything with their beautiful silvery glow. It had also been filled with people, music, laughter, and magic. Now it was as silent and empty as an abandoned tomb. I walked further into the room, the remnants of old magic touching me like cobwebs. That was all that remained of the place I'd known. Everything else was gone. "I don't understand," I whispered. Ian looked around, then inhaled deeply.
"Barely a hint of scent anywhere. This place hasn't seen action in a decade at least. How long did you say it's been since you were here?"
"Not that long," I began, then paused. I guess it had been a while.
10 years ago? 20?
When I stayed silent, his stare grew pointed.
"More?"
"A little over 90 years," I said, feeling sheepishness wash over me.
90? He repeated in disbelief. "Why in blazes did you pick this place, then?"
"It was the most recent magic club I'd been to," I admitted. His brows nearly flew into his hairline.
90 years? Blimey, no wonder you're so uptight. Every senior citizen in the world has cut loose more recently than you.
I stiffened. "I don't appreciate the sarcasm, and I don't appreciate my balls freezing to my bishop," he interrupted.
"Yet here we are. And since we're being honest, you've got something stuck in your teeth."
"What?" "I didn't remember eating any real food."
"Right between the two front ones,"
he said, pulling out a compact cosmetic mirror from his pocket. He must be more vain than I'd realized, bringing that with him. I'd brought weapons.
"See for yourself," he said, holding the compact open.
I glanced at the mirror, and the dark cavern vanished, while an endless array of mirrors shot up to surround me. I tried to run, and more popped up, blocking my path. Incensed, I punched the nearest one. The shiny reflective surface didn't even crack. Instead, more mirrors appeared, until I began to feel dizzy from the endless copies of myself. "Damn you, Ian!" I shouted, punching another mirror. Once again, it did nothing except make my fist sore. I couldn't see him, but the laughter that rumbled into my ears was unmistakably his.
I can't believe you fell, for you have something in your teeth. Really, little guardian, that has to be as old as you are.
I stopped my attempts to beat my way out of this. They only served to increase the mirrors and my own sense of disorientation. Impressive spell, I said, in a tone that belied the rage coursing through me. Where did you learn it? Another laugh, sounding closer this time.
From a witch who caught me and several other vampires in it. None of us could get free until the spell expired. Necromancers couldn't break it when we used it on them later. Even Menkerys hadn't heard of it. That's how I reckoned it should work against you.
He'd actually shown me a spell I'd never seen before.
I'd be impressed if I wasn't so furious.
Don't congratulate yourself yet. I'm not done trying to get out of this. It sounded as if he'd settled himself into a more comfortable position.
By all means, do your best, but the spell expires in 3 hours. If you can't find a way out by then, I win.
I could buy more time by using my abilities to freeze it, but I wouldn't use that power unless I had to. Until then, I had other tricks to try. By the end of the 1st hour, I was cursing Ian in every language I knew, although I made sure to do it in my head since vocalizing the curses only amused him. When I was well into the 2nd hour, I'd stopped being angry. Instead, I was testing the limits of the spell with a growing sense of excitement. So far, I'd been unable to beat it. Blasting all my supernatural power at the mirrors did nothing to break them. I finally resorted to freezing time in an attempt to move around the mirrors while everything was still. It didn't work. Punching and kicking the mirrors only served to multiply them. So did stabbing them with one of the silver knives I'd hidden in my boots. In fact, the mirrors were so impervious to harm, I finally came to the conclusion that they couldn't be real. If they were, I should have been able to at least cause a hairline crack in one. The fact that I hadn't meant I probably wasn't doing any of the things I thought I was doing. For all I knew, I was still standing in the same spot I'd been when I first looked into the mirror Ian had spelled to become a trap. If so, I shouldn't be focused on trying to destroy the mirrors or get away from them. I shouldn't pay attention to them at all. Instead, I needed to focus on myself. I closed my eyes, taking in deep breaths in an attempt to center myself. It sounded like Ian shifted from his seated position.
Breathing? Think you can meditate your way out of this?
I ignored the amusement in his tone to focus on the more important issue. He'd noticed what I was doing. He hadn't commented on any specifics of my actions before. That only strengthened my suspicion that I hadn't been doing any of it. Ian would have been unable to resist mocking me for trying to beat my way through the mirrors, let alone my other efforts. I continued to focus on my breathing, until through force of will, I couldn't hear Ian anymore, despite the fact that he was still talking. After several minutes, I became aware of something I'd been oblivious to since this ordeal had started. The feel of cold, hard stone beneath me. I must be on the ground, sprawled out, judging from the chilliness against my arms, legs, and torso. I must have been like this the whole time, considering how cold my limbs felt. Oh, what a clever spell. If I could, I'd congratulate the person who'd created it. Like quicksand, the more I'd struggled to escape it, the deeper I'd sunk into it. This spell could be useful in my attempt to bring Dagon down, while trying to ensure that both Ian and I survived. And if I could breathe, then I could move. If I could move, I could reach my silver knife for real this time. No matter how ancient or powerful, all spells ceased in one of 3 ways. When they were finished, when they were beaten, or when the bespelled person died. I just needed to intensify my focus first. I concentrated on my breathing until nothing else existed and nothing else mattered. Then, when I was hovering between that perfect state of complete self-awareness and complete oblivion, I reached down and pulled my silver knife from my boot. Son of a bitch. Ian's muttered curse broke through my concentration, but it was confirmation that I'd succeeded in actually getting the knife this time. I trusted his reaction more than I did the feel of smooth silver in my hand. I'd been fooled by my senses before with this spell. It took another few minutes before I could wheel myself back to where I was able to move the knife again. This time I brought it to my chest, and instantly felt an unseen force seize my hand.
What the bloody hell do you think you're doing?
Ian sounded as if he was snarling the words into my ear, but when I opened my eyes, I saw nothing except mirrors. I couldn't see his hand on mine, and now I could no longer feel it, but I knew he was still gripping my wrist. What was I doing? I was making sure that I could do what was necessary to end this spell. This spell might be useful in our trap for Dagon, but the demon was far more powerful than I. If I'd figured out a way out of this, he would too. It had taken me the better part of 3 hours. I didn't dare to hope it would take Dagon that long. He wasn't just more powerful than me, he was also eons older. For all I knew, he'd been the creator of this spell, for all magic had its origin in demons. Besides, if I did what was necessary to defeat this spell in front of Ian, he would figure out what I was. I couldn't let that happen, since I didn't want to kill Ian. Surprisingly, that wasn't out of fear for what Menkaris would do. No, it was Ian's devotion to his sire that had changed my mind. The kind of loyalty that looked hell in the eye, and told it to do its worst because nothing would make you endanger the person you loved. That was rare, well deserving of protection. The bruise to my ego was a small price to pay. Better to have Ian think he'd used a spell on me I couldn't defeat. Let him revel in his supposed win. It might be best to let Ian take the lead on choosing the hot spots anyway. Had it really been 90 years since I'd gone out for some fun? How embarrassing. And if I did strongly disagree about Ian's methods, I could wait until I was out of his eyesight, then extract myself from this spell. Ian would never even know I'd done it. Decision made, I opened my eyes, seeing only never-ending reflections of myself in the countless mirrors. You win.
Come again?
Ian said, sounding surprised. You win, I repeated.
I can't break the spell, and my time is almost up, isn't it? 5 more minutes.
He still sounded much closer.
Why do I have the distinct impression that you haven't truly given up? I don't know what you intended before, but you damn near stabbed yourself in the heart, so I'm not letting go of your wrist.
I couldn't tell if I smiled for real, or if the spell only tricked me into believing it. And you saved me. My hero.
My ass, he responded at once. Somehow you're playing me. I can feel it.
He had good instincts.
It's probably what had kept him alive when one of the underworld's most powerful demons had been after him for decades.
But there was a time-tested truism on my side. Men always wanted to believe they'd won a match of wits against a woman, even if their instincts told them otherwise. How many different ways do you want to hear me say you won? I asked in a faux exasperated tone. Very well, I concede, I surrender, I hand over my sword, I wave the white flag.
Enough.
His voice changed. Suspicion gave way to the steel of resolve.
As I've told you before, I can wait to find out what you're hiding from me, but make no mistake, I will find out. What's more,
now silkiness replaced that steel.
You'll tell me willingly, little guardian.
It had to be the spell that caused me to feel as if his words danced along my nerve endings. Yes, that's what it was, I told myself firmly. The spell.
If I had a secret as big as you're implying, I replied, I'd never share it with you.
He laughed, low, sensual, and oh so enticingly confident.
Now that is a wager. You will lose. Count on it.
Chapter 11. The entrance to our hotel had been swept clean, but the rest of Times Square was still coated with streamers, confetti, and other remnants from celebrations the night before. Seeing it, I wasn't sorry we'd spent New Year's Eve over the border in Canada. Not that I had anything against confetti or streamers. It was the crushing crowds I wasn't fond of. Times Square on New Year's Eve was the epitome of that. When we exited the hotel, the bellhop offered to hail a cab for us. Ian turned to me.
Up for a walk instead?
Sure. My ice-blue dress might be formal, but it didn't restrict my stride. And since I was a vampire, I couldn't get blisters despite today's foot-contorting high heels. Ian offered me his arm, which I took after a brief arch of my brow. Careful, someone might mistake you for a gentleman. He flashed a grin at me.
Anyone who'd make such a mistake deserves what they get.
His smile made his looks even more distracting, and that was quite an accomplishment. Once again, we'd gotten a suite with two bedrooms, so we'd had privacy while readying ourselves for tonight. When Ian had come out of his room with his auburn hair slicked back so his impossibly beautiful features were highlighted for maximum effect, wearing a tuxedo that draped his tall, muscled form as if the tailor who'd fit it for him had been in love, I'd had to look away before I did something ridiculous, like proposition him on the spot. I don't know why I was having such a strong reaction to him. A week ago, I'd seen him naked and felt less affected. But I hadn't really seen Ian as a man then. I'd seen him as a necessary burden that might end up stabbing me in the back. Now I knew Ian was dangerously smart, complicated, loyal, powerful, lethal, sexy, and arrogant, proudly so. He took every second and third glance from the normally jaded New Yorkers as his due. He even flashed pitying looks at the people who abruptly turned and began to follow him, glancing at me before raising a brow at them, as if to say, "Sorry, I'm hers tonight, and yes, that is your loss." After several instances of this, I was getting irritated. These people could clearly see my arm folded in his. Did I need to take more drastic measures to show that he was not available for their pleasure? Perhaps I'd feed from the next person who spun around and began to follow him like an animal catching an irresistible scent. Gods, I muttered out loud. What was wrong with me? Ian glanced at me.
Something amiss?
No, I said, while thinking, yes. Nearly all vampires were possessive over their personal food sources, their offspring, and their lovers, yet Ian was none of those to me. I'd never turned a human into a vampire, so I couldn't speak for offspring, but I'd never experienced that trademark surge of territoriality with any of my former lovers, or the humans I'd put under my protection. For the past 4,000 years, I'd been glad to find myself above such pettiness. So why was I now fantasizing about biting every male and female who had done nothing more than make their interest in Ian known? Lack of control, I decided, in a grab for an excuse. I was in the very unfamiliar position of being spellbound into following Ian's lead tonight. I must be trying to distract myself from that by inventing a possessiveness I didn't really feel. Yes, that had to be it. Which act would you prefer for tonight? His questions broke through my musings. I was all too glad for the interruption. What do you mean? He shrugged.
There's the new lovers act, the friends who fuck act, the swingers act, the gold digger and sugar daddy act, the fighting couple act.
What about a platonic friendship act? I interrupted. He looked at me as if I'd finally spoken a language he couldn't understand.
Is that a joke?
Hardly. You might be attractive, but not everyone wants to have sex with you. As soon as I said it, I cringed. Did that sound as overly defensive as I felt?
No, some people also want to kill me, he said at once. Some want me to turn them into a vampire. Some want my money, some want me for my rare artifacts, some for my fighting skills. And one wants to dangle me out as bait for a demon she's trying to kill. See, no one is with me simply to be with me.
Guilt pricked me, followed by a rush of empathy. I knew what it was like to be considered an object first and a person last. In fact, I couldn't remember the last time someone had been with me just to be with me either. Wait. Yes, I could. Tenok. Loneliness and a far deeper wave of guilt swelled, followed as always by pain. How could I have not known what Tenok was trying to tell me the last time we were together? How could I have been so blind as to miss that he'd been saying goodbye? As much as I wanted to, I could do nothing for Tenok. But I could do something for the man next to me, if Ian allowed himself to accept it. I might be with you for ulterior reasons now, but it's well established that it's been a while since I've gone out for fun, I said in a carefully nonchalant tone. And whatever else you are fun, Ian. So, assuming we're both still alive when this is over, would you accompany me for an evening out? He looked at me in amazement. Then he began to laugh.
Offering me a pity date? Now I've heard everything.
It's not pity and it's not a date, I said, a testier note creeping into my tone when he continued to laugh as if I'd told the funniest joke ever. Since you've never gone out with someone just as a friend, and I'm in clear need of an update on places to have a good time, I thought... Oh, never mind if you can't stop laughing at me.
My apologies, he said, still chuckling. It's only that I can't decide which is funnier. My being pitied for an assumed lack of companionship, or the look on people's faces if they saw you, a venerated law guardian, out with an infamous law-scorning rakehell like me.
He was right that I'd hear no less than a decade's worth of snide remarks from some of the more sexist council members, not to mention a few from my fellow law guardians, too. But that didn't matter. Long ago, I decided I wouldn't let other people's disapproval dictate my actions. So, as the saying goes, I can handle it if you can. His laughter stopped and something flashed over his face, too quick for me to pinpoint what it was before it was gone.
If you hadn't played a part in the execution of my friend's child, I think I would very much like you, Veritas.
She's still alive. I couldn't say that out loud without endangering her, and I wouldn't do that despite the surprisingly strong urge I had to redeem myself in Ian's eyes. On that awful day, I'd been close enough to the little girl to know she wasn't the real human-vampire-ghoul hybrid who'd been sentenced to death. She was a demon-branded shapeshifter disguised to look like her. Thankfully, the council members and other law guardians hadn't noticed. They couldn't sense demons the way I could. When I realized the switch had been made, I knew I didn't have to freeze time to save her, which was what I'd intended. I told Ian none of that. All I said was, "You'll never forgive me for her death, will you?" As if there were any doubt. His calling me by my name instead of his usual moniker of Little Guardian had been enough to tell me how serious he was.
"No, I won't,"
he said in a low, steady tone. I met his eyes and held them. Good. Some things should remain unforgivable. I'd never forgive Dagon for what he'd done. Every once in a while, I still woke up screaming from the memories. Unlike the popular saying, time did not heal all wounds. In truth, I was grateful for Ian's reminder of how he saw me, as another merciless player in the execution of a child whose only crime was frightening the bigoted because she'd been born different. Now I could stop with these ridiculous thoughts and feelings about Ian. They were a waste of time, and more importantly, a waste of energy. Nothing mattered except bringing Dagon down. Tonight was one more step toward accomplishing that. "Pick whatever act you want," I said, and stared straight ahead for the rest of the walk. Chapter 12. Central Park was bathed in a blanket of white. Lights from the surrounding buildings reflected off the snow and made it appear to glimmer. New York was the city that never slept. But at midnight, at the famous park located in the heart of the city, things appeared to be winding down. I'd been to New York City many times for business, but I couldn't remember the last time I'd strolled through Central Park. A few decades? Longer? Many things appeared new, such as the Alice in Wonderland sculpture and the ice skating rink. I had seen Belvedere Castle before, but back then it had been in a state of disrepair. Now the faux castle looked fully renovated. It was also the location of exhibit rooms, an observation deck, and the local weather station, according to a sign we passed. Ian took us around the main entrance of the castle to the backside of it. There, on the rocky foundation that faced a small pond, he stopped and gave me a serious look.
"I've been asking your preference on things, because I don't want the spell to force you into acting against your will. But I don't trust you not to return here in your official capacity later. That's why I'm claiming one of my acts of obedience. By the spell that binds us, Veritas, I command that you will never prosecute anyone for their magical actions tonight. And you will also never tell